My guest today, Barry Cryer, was in Bristol recently singing My Old Man's a Dustman to the tune of Heartbreak Hotel. For a man in his eighth decade, he still moves beautifully. Barry's best known, of course, as a panellist on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, on which he's been appearing since 1972. But his career began much, much earlier than that. As a comedy writer, he knows no equal. Frost, Morecambe and Wise, Tommy Cooper, Bob Hope, Kenny Everett, Dave Allen, just a brief selection of the performers who've complained down the years about the quality of his jokes. I thought Barry would probably choose someone from the world of comedy for this edition of Great Lives, but in fact, he nods in the direction of his Yorkshire roots in choosing a different type of character entirely. Barry, tell us whom you've nominated and why.
I've nominated J.B. Priestley, the man's gift for character and storytelling and everything. When I discovered him, he became an absolute idol. And I actually knew him.
Did he look like we remember him, like Orson Welles in one of those Sherry adverts, big, heavy, set face?
He was smaller than you expected. And he played the curmudgeon, the grumpy Yorkshireman, to the hilt, but also the twinkle. Great romantic, if you read his stuff. The man was a romantic underneath all that, but he played the role.
How did you get to know him?
Well, I was having a very good liquid lunch with Graham Chapman, Monty Python, years ago, and Graham said to me, "You're a bore on the subject of J.B. Priestley." And Graham used to talk and think like this. He said, "Ring him." And I remembered Wendy at Yorkshire Television. They'd done a documentary about J.B. I said to Wendy, "Have you got J.B. Priestley's phone number?" She said, "Yes." Rang this number, Alverston, outside Stratford-on-Avon. And a woman answered. I thought, "Oh, that's the secretary." Click. "Hello." I sobered up in about 2 seconds flat. And I said, "My name's Barry Cryer." "Is it indeed?" And I thought, what's the most innocuous, least worrying thing I can say? I said, "My mate and I want to have tea with you, if that's possible. You're mad." Then I floated away on a pink cloud because he suddenly said, "I've heard you on the wireless." And then he said, "Who's your mate?" And I said, "Graham Chapman." And he said, "Monty Python." Keen fan of Monty Python, JB. And he was furious because it wasn't being broadcast in the Midlands. And then Monty Python did the first stage show at the Belgrade Theatre.
He asked you over to meet him.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And Monday at 3 o'clock, he said, I must point out, I'm giving up my walk. And I went to see my mates in Monty Python at the Belgrade Theatre, Coventry, not a million miles from Alverston outside Stratford-on-Avon. We hired a car and we went down there. And I met the cleaning lady who answered the phone. And we stayed for about 2¾ hours. It was wonderful. And then the bookcase opened while we were talking to him. And his wife, Jaquetta, came up. She was listening to make sure it wasn't This Is Your Life or something. You know? And then I knew him. We kept in touch ever afterwards. They had me and my wife down for dinner. I took the great man to the Café Royal in London, walking down Piccadilly on a summer night with his Sandyman's Port hat on and his cloak. I was floating on air. And we went in the Café Royal and an older waiter said, "Mr. Priestley, what a pleasure to see you again." Jack said to me, "I haven't been here for bloody 30 years. And it was great. We were talking over dinner that night, and I was saying, "And then you, and then what happened then? Is this a conversation or an interview?" Oh, we'd cut you short right there. But it was done with a twinkle.
Here he is, talking on Kaleidoscope, another sad demise, on his 82nd birthday.
There's no serene tranquility about me at all. Inside me, there's a young man struggling to get out and resenting these wrinkles, grey hairs and the burden of years.
Can we just talk for a moment about your book on English humorists? What made you want to do a book like this?
Probably money. I don't know.
Is that the voice you remember, Barry?
Yes, very much so, yes. And Graham Chapman smoked a pipe. So that was the lead into the conversation. They just talked about tobacco. We got in there on that basis, but that's the voice I remember, very much so.
Also here, we've got Martin Wainwright, the Northern editor of The Guardian and presenter of a very fine documentary last year about Priestley's Postscripts, his famous radio talks at the start of the Second World War. Martin, was Priestley, as he was somewhat seen to be, a typical Yorkshireman?
Well, he was very sweet-natured and modest, as Barry said. which you perhaps wouldn't instinctively think is a Yorkshire characteristic, but I think the stage Yorkshireman side of him was a compensation for this tremendous self-assurance that he appeared to have, almost kind of cocksure, I think was to compensate for the fact that underneath he wasn't like that. And people who met him almost universally say how nice he was, how friendly he was. So there's that side of things. I think his second great Yorkshire characteristic was the voice. I mean, that slow, deliberate voice. And it's very interesting hearing that excerpt where the interviewer sounds like somebody from the 1920s all of a sudden, whereas Priestley, go to Bradford today and you will hear Priestley's talking. I mean, it's why we're all, not me, but many of my fellow county people are employed in call centres, because you feel your money is quite safe. somebody like that. And a third, just a third thing is, it's maybe a Bradfordian thing. People have a very wrong image of Bradford, and particularly in his day, it was an international centre of wool. And he was an adventurous man. He was an explorer. Like a lot of people in Bradford, he wrote himself, he said they looked as if they'd never been further than Morecambe, which is where everybody in Bradford used to go for their holidays. But they actually knew every continental timetable of the trains because they were all out there selling wool and way beyond that. And he was to show in his life, you know, how far afield he went.
The person he reminds me of is a kind of literary Geoffrey Boycott, in a way. You know, apparently a bit grumpy on the surface, but he admitted himself that he had, in his own words, a hell of a lot of talent. Although, in the same breath, he said he had no genius. He's a splendid grumbler. Are you a splendid grumbler, Barry?
Yes, I've worked on it. We're also arrogant in our humility. We affect a great modesty as well. You know, you're brought up, don't be too big for your boots. And JB had a very keen appreciation of his own talent, but would always qualify it. He said about his famous prose scripts, his radio, as a radio performer, I was overrated and overpraised. He said that deliberately, because it did rankle with him that he'd written all those novels and all those plays and all those essays and autobiography. And he said for years afterwards, all they talked about was the postscripts on the radio.
What brought you to Priestley first? Which part of his work did you like?
Well, I've been reading some of the lesser things, like Salt is Leaving and things like that. And we were on holiday in Cornwall, and I wandered into a bookshop, and there was the Penguin Good Companions. And I thought, I've never read that, the big iconic one.
His first novel, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. And I bought it, and that was the holiday gone, family, you know, in the sunshine. I was just locked into that book straight away, and from then on it was voracious. I went and found Angel Pavement, and I've got a shelf full at home. I've just been rereading Lost Horizons, and I'm reading Bright Day. You know, it's like sitting in an armchair when you start a Priestley book. He draws you in, and the characters and the narrative is just wonderful. I think he's a master, and so prolific. I mean, I hope I'm not overstating. It's Dickensian and Shakespearean in his gift to turn it out to such quality.
Martin, in a nutshell, let's just quickly trot through his upbringing and his early years.
Well, he was a lucky man, in a way, because he had three parents. He had his mum and dad, but his mum very sadly died when he was only two. She got ovarian cancer and died. But then he then had a stepmum. His dad married again. And he said she was the exact opposite of the evil stepmother of children's fairy stories. She was a lovely woman. But his mother, Emma, was also a lovely woman, and by all accounts, a very, very lively woman. Her father was one of the best-known pub landlords in Bradford. He used to organise charabang tours for his regulars. And she, Emma was famous for... She was thrown out of the Alhambra Theatre in Bradford for laughing too much. also apparently at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And also she... When his dad was having meetings with socialist cronies, Emma used to parade in the garden outside the window and also have a broom with a hat on, as if she was with some fancy man. And so although Priestley never really knew his mum, some of his great humour and liveliness was inherited from her. And his dad was a school headmaster, and he, I don't know if there are any dinner ladies here, but if so, he invented the dinner lady because his school was the first in Britain to serve school dinners, and that was because of Jonathan Priestley. So he was a high-minded man who I think installed the work ethic
Because of his job, he was entitled, he'd been working in the wool trade, to a free pass every year, apparently, on a shipping line. So he decided to go on a trip from Hull to Copenhagen. Let me read you this about his trip. I don't have the right accent to read it in, really. I think I'm going to ask Barry to read it. I'm going to sideline it here, Barry, and just ask you to read the bit between quotes there.
Oh, because of his job?
But... Yeah, yes. No, no, just in quotes.
Which bit do you... Oh, yes, right, I've got it. Is this too glossy for you? I took my breakfast out in a courtyard, and there facing me was a factory where delectable girls at every window looked, pointed, giggled.
He liked women, didn't he?
He certainly did. Right. He did. But in a good way, if you see what I mean. I mean,
Yes.
Yeah. He really enjoyed the company of women, and they enjoyed his company.
My wife and I were invited down to dinner at Alveston by J.B. and Jaquetta, and I went to the loo during the course of the evening, and Jaquetta took me down this marble hall to the loo. And my wife was sitting there with a great man wearing sandals, very hot evening, and he put his finger between the sole of her foot and the sandal and tickled her and said, they're determined to leave us alone, aren't they? And she said it wasn't remotely offensive. It was really warm and playful, but she, oh, yeah, she liked him.
Yes, although...
Sorry, I went off on a tangent then, didn't I?
Although she was heard to remark once that his body was not a thing of beauty.
No. Don't judge a book by its cover.
No.
I think Robert Robinson, you know, the great Radio 4 man, he was a pal of Priestley's, and he had a very attractive wife, and the same thing, Priestley.
Yeah.
Kept sort of getting her on her own. And
tell me a little bit about his evolution from... working in the wool trade to becoming a writer. You don't do that easily, do you, Martin? How did he go about it?
Well, he was 20 in 1914.
Mm.
And some people say John Brain, another writer from the Bradford era from Bingley, reckoned that he was destroyed in the First World War and that a different Priestley came up at the end. And he also has this theory that one reason Priestley wrote and wrote and wrote was to keep the war out of his head. A big shell exploded yards from him and buried him and badly injured him in 1916, and he was gassed in 1917. He said, like a lot of them did for that time, the best were chosen and sent to be killed, and he witnessed that. And I think that was the changing of Priestley. He had done some writing before then of a rather sort of studenty, light-hearted nature, but after that, when he came back from the Western Front, I think it was all different.
My producer, I think, actually has a copy of his letter to his father about exactly this, and perhaps, Barry, if we could hand you the copy of that letter and you would just read it for us.
From J.B. to his father. I've seen some terrible sights and endured some hardships, but believe me, I never lost my nerve, and strange to say, I felt a strange exultation of the soul at the expense of the body. Do not be afraid for me. I am not afraid.
Mm. So we have, perhaps within himself, during the war and in his work after the war, this strange change from a slightly ill-at-ease Yorkshireman to a powerful, best-selling author. It starts... doesn't it, with a scholarship to Cambridge?
Yes, the army, it's often said that the heroes were not treated properly, but one of the things they did do was offer a number of scholarships to returning soldiers and military people, and he got one and he went to Cambridge, but he didn't like it at all, and I think he felt that the officer class... I must be careful what I say in Bristol, because you've got a statue of one just up on the hill, but he resented that sort of the people who sent the soldiers again and again to be killed. And at Cambridge, I think he felt he came up against them again. But anyway, he saw it through. Because he had a friend who'd been appointed editor of a magazine in London, he took the brave decision at the age of, I think, about 28. He had £50 capital and a young wife, and he said, right, I'm going to London and I'm going to be a freelance writer.
He once said, there are occasions in man's existence when he must make something happen, must fling a flash of colour into his life, or some part of him, perhaps the boy in him, will perish, flying before the grey armies of age, timidity and boredom. It seems as if this was that moment for him.
And he cited an advert which had a photograph of somebody getting older and older and older, and in Priestley's eyes getting, you know, more and more boring, and it was an advert for pensions. And the final picture was of a sort of old but relieved-looking man who'd got his pension, and Priestley just thought, that is not what I want. And the book, his first great book, which made his name in a way that's, you know, I was trying to think of modern parallels. They're not really appropriate in a sense, but, you know, there's like this guy Stieg Larsson and so on. I mean, he was on that scale, the Good Companions. That's all about three very different people who do what he did. They say, right, we're not going to stay stuck in our rut. We're going off out into the world.
Well, when did you decide, Barry, that you were not going to get stuck in a rut and you were not going to perish flying before the grey armies of age to the boredom?
I've never had a plan, Matthew. I've been dogged by good luck all my life. I was at Leeds University. I'm BA English, failed Leeds University. And Blue Eyes got to university and blew it. And a man came up to Leeds to see somebody in the student show. Not me. Saw me telling jokes and offered me work. And I got his offer of work in one hand and my first year results in the other. No contest. Suddenly I was in show business and all sorts.
You're listening to Great Lives, where Barry Cryer has nominated J.B. Priestley, author of An Inspector Calls and a huge range of other work. Also here is Martin Wainwright. Let's hear another couple of clips. First, Tom Priestley, J.B.'s son, to whom our producer spoke last week, followed by J.B. himself, talking about his family's relationship with his world-famous grumbling. First, Tom.
He loved young children because, really, they came from the world of the imagination. It was that sort of innocence. The love of stories, the love of magic. And so he invented a sort of strange secret society for me and my younger sister. I had five sisters, by the way. My mother always said if he was in a dark mood, she'd send the two of us in, and after a while we'd start playing some game and he would instantly cheer up.
They believed that grumbling made everything worse, whereas I believed it made things better. For example, if we were staying in an hotel and had a bad breakfast, they said my grumbling made it worse. But I'd reply that although I'd had a bad breakfast, I had at least enjoyed a good grumble.
He's sounding a bit like Roy Hattersley there. You spoke earlier, Barry, about The Good Companions.
Yes.
A book that you liked, and it was a hugely successful novel, his first novel. He, it seems, had mixed feelings about The Good Companions. His agent or his publisher told him it needed to be picaresque with a happy ending, and he made it picaresque and submitted the manuscript saying, and it's got seven happy endings, will that do?
Oh, yes.
And it did do, and it was a vast publishing success.
Yeah.
But he seemed dissatisfied with it.
Well, he was a perfectionist, but I think, with great respect to the great man, I think he did enjoy commercial success.
Yes.
He did like being a bestseller.
He did.
And he would undercut it by saying, I want to write a novel that I would enjoy reading if nobody else does. I didn't believe a word of that. He wanted to write a novel that a lot of people would like, and why not?
But this, Martin, is something that slightly irritates me about him. He did enjoy success, and he did have success in spades, and he had a huge commercial success, and yet he used to complain quite a lot that he wasn't getting the literary esteem that he deserved. He once said, if I'd written Anna Karenina, it would have been assumed among the elite that I was still turning out twaddle for the mob. I get a bit tired of popular writers moaning that no one takes them seriously. It was like the sitcom star that wants to play Hamlet. Why did he want to be a succès d'estime as well as just being a success?
Well, he was very wounded. You know, people said very nasty things about him. Virginia Woolf called him a tradesman writer. So, you know, he goes round the back way kind of thing. The literary elite, whose books sold many, many fewer copies, which I suspect is, you know, what it was all about, really didn't go for him. Interestingly, the second best-selling novelist of the 1930s was Daphne du Maurier, and they said the same about her. You know, yeah. Rebecca was dismissed as crowd-pleasing.
Have you ever been known to complain, Barry, that people don't take your work seriously?
No, not at all. I always remember the joke Bob Monkhouse used to do. He said, when I was young, I wanted to be a comedian. They laughed at me then. They're not laughing now.
In 19 broadcasts between June the 5th and October the 20th, 1940, Priestley built up an audience of perhaps 40% of the adult British population. His occasionally left-wing views alarmed the establishment, though he stopped doing his first run of talks, apparently voluntarily. The main problem was he was obviously extremely English, extremely patriotic, but he was somewhat left of centre, and there were people who didn't like that. Churchill didn't like that. Do you think that he was sort of drummed off the airwaves, Martin?
No, I think it was a mixture. I mean, the BBC have always defended themselves by saying the amount of time he was given was absolutely unprecedented, as indeed was the amount of money he was paid, although he didn't feel it was enough. But it bore out what Barry said about Dickens. And you know, we talk of him as a writer, but he was a wonderful broadcaster.
Yeah.
And he wrote those postscripts that evening, and then the way he delivered them was fantastic.
Yeah, and then complained that they were too successful. Let's just hear his own thoughts here about those postscript talks.
Suddenly, with these radio talks, I had millions and millions of fans. My mail arrived in bulging post bags. I couldn't ask for a drink in a bar without my voice being immediately recognised, and people crowding round me. I liked being reasonably well known, we all do, but I soon began to dislike being celebrated on this gigantic semi-hysterical scale.
He was, Barry, a socialist in a vague sort of way. He was a lifelong supporter of the Labour Party. He disliked class so intensely that Evelyn Waugh remarked that J.B. Priestley had been unpleasantly surprised by the fact that the upper classes hadn't been put in concentration camps after the Second World War. And yet, he was always complaining about money, complaining that people weren't paying him enough, the BBC weren't paying him enough, although he became a pretty rich man, bought a Georgian house in Highgate. There's a little bit of a sort of champagne socialist here.
Yes, there's a lovely quote, I think Martin would know this about. He did a Labour Party broadcast and wasn't paid, didn't he? Somewhat for nout. That was it. Yes, he did it. But there was always an underlying, I want my going rate, you know, I'm a professional, I want paying. You know, he was saying, Matthew, about the commercial success, and Martin was mentioning Daphne du Maurier. I think there's a lot of envy about if someone's enormously successful. So therefore, they're made not members of the club, but they're their own club. They should have laid back and enjoyed it.
Although I think that grumbling is a complete pose, actually. Yeah. I think he just loved doing that grumble stuff, and I'm sure he didn't really believe it. But because, you know, once he'd stopped the postscripts, once the war was over, he then produced Bright Day, which you mentioned, which he thought a lot of people think is his best novel. And the famous An Inspector Calls, you know, because his whole dramatic output is another thing. That's always on that play. I'm sure it's being done at the minute.
And he went on tours. He went on a tour of Canada, where he apparently came back convinced that no real sex had ever occurred in Canada. But the more serious side, there was the launch of CND, and he's credited with being a very important force in the creation of CND.
He and Canon Collins, wasn't
yes.
it? Martin,
yes,
you're
well,
the...
Well, he wrote this article in the New Statesman called The British and the Nuclear Bombs, and that did start CND. I mean, it wasn't just him, but that article triggered it. And as you say, Canon Collins, he did rather like Diana Collins. That was another of his chums.
He said to us, I think, that first time we met him, he said, I've been venerated and reviled in Russia. I've been venerated and reviled in America. You know, the Russians saw him as a great proletarian writer and then sort of thought he's just an American lackey when he had success. And the Americans knew his quality and success as a bestseller. Then he was a lefty and probably commie in those horrible days. So he said, I've been up and down everywhere.
I think he ploughed his own furrow. I mean, in the end, he wasn't a joiner.
No.
He was a starter of things, but not a man who wanted to see
Harold Wilson offered him a seat in the House of Lords, which he decided not to take.
Because of Vietnam, supposedly. Yeah. You always wonder with Priestley whether there were other reasons, but that was the official reason. He didn't support their policy on Vietnam.
And all this time, he's turning out what is, as you say, Barry, an absolutely enormous volume of work. Books and books and plays, some of which were huge. Is there any consistency in his work? Can you tell me what J.B. Priestley is about as a playwright?
One thing, as Martin well knows, time obsessed him. He had a time theme in his plays about nostalgia, and you meet somebody and you go back in your head in time. There's a superb play called Dangerous Corner, which starts, the whole bunch of characters goes around in a full circle and starts again. But the second beginning is different from the first one. He was playing with time all the time. But he was just a master of character in his books and his plays to me. Oh, I think he's the master. I'm sorry, I can't be... sorry to be vague.
I think you're absolutely right, Barry. And his other great thing is, I think he delighted in life, which is not going to endear you to the sort of sceptical literary elite. And in 1971, when he was becoming really quite an old man, he wrote a book called Snoggle. You'll have seen E.T., I guess, the film. Well, Snoggle, which predated E.T., was about two aliens who came to Earth. The government wanted them to be shot because they thought they were coming to take over the Earth. And a family of children saw them back onto their spaceship. I don't know if that's where E.T. came from, but it's the same story. And the fact that at that age, you know, he just had this tremendous, ebullient enthusiasm.
Well, I'll speak for the sneery literary elite whom you cite, Martin. I've read a certain amount of Priestley. I've seen one or two of his plays. I went to see Time and the Conways last year. Beautifully produced, very well acted. It's awfully watchable. It's awfully readable. You're quite right, Barry. The characters are completely believable. And when it's well produced, it's well worth the effort. But where's the magic? When does Priestley take wings and soar? You come away from a Priestley play having been quite absorbed and feeling that beyond entertainment, it was sort of trying to say something, but you aren't quite sure what it was trying to say. Is Priestley really very good?
I think I've said my case. I rest my case. Yeah, I think there's a spiralling off during his plays and novels when it really gets on another plane to me, when there is some, not in any pretentious way, but there is some real magic going on, Matthew, so we'll have to have a friendly disagreement there.
And I think one thing with Priestley may be that he said in one of his later plays, happiness cannot be adequately described. That's why we read so little about it, whereas millions of words are spent on the misery surrounding it. And it may be that in 100 years' time, Priestley might be seen as somebody who did describe happiness. And if that is the case, that would be no mean achievement.
John Boynton Priestley died in August 1984. My thanks to Barry Cryer for choosing him and to Martin Wainwright for helping us with this recording. Goodbye.